the son of Robert Baratheon. He's the ancestral love child of Jaime and Cersei, right, guys?
Right.
Yes, absolutely.
But do we really know him?
But surely we do, because of his blonde hair and his blue eyes.
That's the trademark the only of way the lion.
He could ever have that lion hair is because of his incest, right? Like, there's no mm-hmm. chance that maybe Cersei was just recreationally sleeping with her beautiful brother.
Recreationally?
Nah. Is that like they play soccer beforehand?
Hey, Mike is here, guys. Mike is here.
So they have to stay in shape somehow.
I missed you last week. And yeah, they do have
to
stay
in shape. I missed the show. I missed you guys.
Did you really?
I really did, yeah. I'm happy to be back.
Micah, you'd be happy to know that right now I'm wearing a bathrobe in a hotel room. It's a soft robe. And I'm sitting here, and we were talking. The reason we started with this topic this week is because Selena posted an article in our workflow, and she knows everything about genetics, right, Selena?
Yeah. Ask me anything.
Can you tell us the difference between a dominant and a recessive gene?
Oh, yeah, I can, of course. A dominant gene is like with eyes. When you have blue eyes, that means... Wait, hold on. If you have brown eyes... No, wait. I do know it. If you have blue eyes, then blue is recessive and brown is dominant. So you can have a brown and a blue, or two blue, but you can't have two brown, obviously. I did learn this once. I know it all.
Or you can have a little shit with blonde hair that kills children who is a child as well.
Yes.
Is that like Tyrion? Doesn't he have two different color eyes?
He does, yeah. But that's an anomaly. Also,
that's a birth defect, actually.
So maybe he's Cersei and Jaime's child.
Wait, are you trying to say that Tyrion has a birth defect, Eric?
No, it's actually, I meant that it's a genetic, it's a mutation.
Apparently green eyes is a mutation, too.
My eyes are my eyes are gray.
That's not a mutation, that's just gray.
Is that a mutation or is it just boring?
I think it's just boring.
Do you guys think that I'm a White Walker, that I'm a person of the snow?
No, they have blue eyes.
Oh, well then, we're good. We're totally
Maybe
figured out.
Maybe they're Lannisters.
Like me.
I guess the fact that I spend my weekends marching along snowy shores with crystal swords and stabbing the townspeople doesn't make me a White Walker.
You're like one of those, what do they call them, the groupies of the White Walkers.
Yeah, well, I'm more of a roadie. I carry all the sheaves for their for their swords and the little ice arrows, you know.
So apparently you can actually be both. I guess this article is like, you can be carrying the recessive trait. And then like still have the dominant trait in you.
I mean, the whole argument, it is just to come in and shake up the community, really, because we know that Joffrey is not Robert's son, but the whole argument sort of stands and falls with the fact that Robert, in this author's this author's understanding of the series, he doesn't have enough bastards that are dark haired, which is Ned's whole argument for why the Lannister children are not his children, because they're not dark haired, because all of his bastards are dark haired. But what she's saying is there's not enough to prove that Robert could not possibly make a blonde child. But I think at some point in the novel it stated he had like 20 or 30 or some ridiculously high number, so I'm not sure it completely holds, but it's interesting to think about.
It's like the Genghis Khan in the Seven Kingdoms.
Isn't there that moment when Ned is sitting down going through that book and you look back at all the lineage and it just shows you that
all
the Baratheons have always had dark hair.
Dark of hair.
Mm-hmm. Dark but of they're hair. Always going to marry someone new, you know? They're
it
always going to marry...
It is known.
They're always going to marry someone new. I mean, the Baratheons aren't incestuous, so they can marry someone who had blonde hair or recessive blonde trait, even if they only marry dark-haired people.
Yeah, there's no reason whatsoever that he couldn't have had Joffrey be blonde, because Cersei is blonde, and even though she's the lady, and it doesn't mean that the child is going to take the dad's hair color. Like, that doesn't happen all the time. Like,
it would be difficult for the Baratheons to be incestuous, though. I mean, how would that work?
They would find someone that would be okay with it, and then they would do it. That's kind of how incest kind of happens. And then the dragons come out of it, and then the world exists afterward, and everybody's happy.
Right.
That makes so much more sense now.
I know. No, this whole argument
week.
Is kind of funny, because I think it's another stab at Ned's intellect, like kind of like how Littlefinger does in the last chapters that we read. But it makes sense, because it especially in the show, Ned kind of is just like, okay, light of hair, dark of hair. This doesn't match. They definitely are not his kids. You know what I mean? Like, it's a very light sort of thing that happened. But I think that the best argument we have for the entire case, and Selena will probably agree with me, is that the only reason I really believe that Joffrey is not the son of Mr. Baratheon is because Mr. Baratheon's children, like Gendry, for example, are way too attractive.
This is true.
Joffrey's just not that hot. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, that's the what Ned should have thought. Been
yeah,
like,
no.
You know, Joffrey's an ugly kid. He has to be.
He's not as physically attractive as Joffrey or Renly, or as Gendry or Renly. So he can't be.
In an age where there's no, you know, paternity test or blood sample or anything about these genes is really, really known. This is all he has to go on.
We destroyed a good section of the books last week, and we talked a lot about Tyrion and Jon saying goodbye to each other. And it was sad. And unfortunately, no one pissed off the wall in that chapter. And that kind of made me sad, too. Because I'm rewatching actually the first season. And when I've been exercising, I've been up on the bike and I've just been watching the show again. And I made this comment inside of my own head. I thought, man, rewatching this is better than watching most shows.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
It really is. And I've seen it a few times. But, you know, especially after us just reading this. And so I'd reach out to a lot of you guys before we start dissecting more of the book this week. But if you have been listening along, and even if you have, like, if you've been reading along, go back and watch some of the older episodes, the ones that we've actually went over and discussed, like from the first season, because it's even like when I saw John and Ned riding apart from each other just outside of Winterfell, when he was like, next time I see you, I'll talk about your mother or whatever, right? Like, I was just like, wow, that scene is so much better now that we've dissected it so much. Like, it just means more to see, you know?
Who is going to tell Jon about his mother?
I don't know. Maybe Varys.
There are a few people
he
left.
He would be, though, the choice. And Zach, you said you're dressed like him right now, right? You're in, like, a silk robe.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Yeah.
Is it dress up like Varys Monday? Is that what this is?
Yeah. No, I'm going to go down to the strip and just demand to go to a spa here in a minute. Like, I need a spa, please.
I feel like you would fit in there, though. You wouldn't have any issues just walking down the strip in a robe.
Maybe. I probably would not. So that's something to look forward to once we're done today. All jokes aside, we've been dissecting the book of the first book of this entire series. Right, guys? What's this book called? It's very original.
A Game of Thrones.
True story. It's kind of what the show is named and based on. And if you look closely to the thing that you're watching, it's called Game of Thrones. We forgot to introduce ourselves earlier, but it's a play on words.
Yeah.
Because we like
so
plays
clever.
On words. I'm done. That's all I'm saying. So someone else has to introduce
Zach,
it.
Zach, like you were saying about the TV series being almost better than the book, or watching it being, you know, better than most series. Like, still the book, I find, has these quotes that are very memorable. And we've been filling your ears with that sort of at the end of each episode with our owns of the week. And even during the show, you know, one-liners, things that we liked. But I have a few of them here, even in the first chapter that we covered this week. A Jon Snow chapter. Again, it takes place at the Wall. And Selena, you said that you found this chapter to be quite upsetting.
Yeah, it was terrible. I was reading this last night, and I was fully planning to read all the chapters. And I got through the Jon chapter, and I was like, okay, this is too depressing. I have to stop because Sam, all through this chapter, is just like. I understand, you know, like when I first read it, I was like, oh, he's crying. That's kind of pathetic. But then reading it again, like, I realize how horrible that is, because he just goes through the most ridiculous amount of crap that I think anyone will have ever gone through in this series. And he just continues to go through crap.
I don't know about that. There are people walking around with half their face burned off.
Yeah, this is true, but I guess you're right. This is Game of Thrones. Everything is terrible. Let's face it.
Right.
But this is particularly, it's just such an intimate pain that he goes through. I don't know. It just really got to me.
I think obviously Jon Snow connects to Sam's pain because it is, as you say, it's of the very internal sort. So I guess they're not that different, really, when you think of it like that. But essentially, I guess Samwell Tarly arrives at the Night's Watch and is immediately struck down in the yard in battle.
It kind of reminded me how Tyrion took a shining to Jon so quickly, because Tyrion obviously knew that Jon was sitting outside at the feast, things like that. Like, he knew that he was getting cast outside for being different in a way, or not being exemplary in a way. And I feel like Jon sort of extended that same amount of kindness to Sam, because Sam was bigger than the other guys and he was slower and he was a little dim-witted. And obviously Thorne is being a dick face, as he usually is. Just Google the image, you'll find something. And was just being kind of a jerk. And John was like, you know what? I'm sort of a jerk back to Thorin a lot because, after all, I am Lord Snow. And so Pip and Grin, not to be confused with Pip and Merry, come out, you know, and they start helping him out. And then their whole sort of like bromance is blossomed in this one chapter, the 26th of them. It's just like it just happens in this one.
And it's great to see.
I thought it was interesting because Jon Snow sort of takes a position of authority among the other boys here. He like... He has this talk with Sam where we learn about Sam's backstory, and then like literally just grants him his protection and goes around to the other boys, like conniving even or convincing them that they too should not attack Sam in the yard.
It's like a mafia.
You know, or at all. And it even involves Ghost at one point, you know, with the last boy. And this is just really intense.
That's
for
when
me,
I would just say, you know what, guys, you win. If there's a dire wolf thrown into the equation, it's just, it's game off, you know, game over.
I'm done.
Yeah. Rast was his name, the boy.
Yeah. If there's a dire wolf, I'm going to peace out. I heard what happened to that guy who tried to stab that kid in Winterfell who can't walk very well anymore.
But it's just so great to see, like, that was a good part of this chapter. This was really like a very emotional moment in the book, because we had that terrible, terrible backstory for Sam, but then we also had this amazing sort of coming together of this is one of the few yay moments in the story, isn't it? Where they just pull together and accomplish something like that. That's so fantastic. And the fact that he makes sure that none of the other boys will hurt Sam is like a big victory for John and for morality.
when he first goes up to Sam and he asks him, have you seen the wall? Sam replies, I'm fat, not blind. Of course I saw it. It's 700 feet high.
You know, it's just like that scene in Sorcerer's Stone when the trio is formed in that bathroom fighting the troll.
It is exactly like that. You're right. It's one of those perfect moments. I did notice something about the whole sequence where Sam sort of reveals what happened in the past, and he reveals that terrible scene where his dad is basically promising him that he would, you know, hunt him down. He says something like, nothing would please me more than to hunt you down like the pig you are, which is just horrendous. But in that scene, his dad is skinning a deer, which I thought maybe was the scene they gave to Tywin Lannister in the show. Like, that's where they got the idea.
I bet you it is. Because it's it's ominous if you're sitting there like, yeah, well, come here, let's have a conversation while I'm disemboweling this creature.
Yeah, he was like ripping out the
exactly.
heart.
Because you've got your killing tools handy.
I don't know if it's like this over where you're from in Sweden, Selena, but for some boys in their teenage years, visiting a girl's house to take her out on a date, the father likes to be cleaning a rifle or a firearm, if you will, like in the living room. So this is sort of the same thing, right?
I think I saw that in Twilight once.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Did they do that in Twilight?
Oh, man. Twilight ruins everything.
So your life is like Twilight? Is that what you're saying?
Twilight is like life, and life is like Twilight. Yeah.
Twilight.
So, yeah, you're right. Life is like 50 Shades of Grey, actually.
Okay.
Wow. The boys are initially taken aback. I wanted to mention this. One of the first things Sam says is that he's a coward. And everybody else is kind of shocked because Jon Snow doesn't know, like, what kind of man would admit to being a coward. And, like, he has to think about it. And then he's like, there's this weird sort of courage to admit you're a coward and stuff. And I don't know if it's courageous, but like they're just immediately, I guess John is disarmed by this kid who has like no self, you know, respect or, you know, has a very low self-esteem for the reasons that we learn later. And I don't know. I thought this was interesting for them to face, because often you see people like Tyrion say, oh, the wall is full of outcasts. But you rarely get an outcast who isn't like still trying to prove that he's awesome,
right?
Until Sam comes along.
And not only that, but he's highborn in a way, right? I mean, he's not from a low family by any stretch.
Right? He wouldn't have owned. He would have had land and like servants and stuff, I think. In fact, his joining the Black was the only way to get his younger brother, who his father thought was more qualified,
Dickon,
to actually inherit all the stuff.
Which is why he had to do it. Otherwise, he would have been stabbed like a pig or whatever, is what his dad said.
Right. There was that as well.
It's kind of sad.
It is sad.
It's terrible.
But I don't know that it's any sadder than anything else that we've seen in this book.
I
feel like we're probably meant to be a little bit more sad because he is so self-deprecating. And he's just like, you know, kind of like pudgy and silly in a way and like fun. And like later, we get his little romance thing that he likes because a girl talks to him. He's just kind of like an unofficial comic relief without a lot of comedy, a lot of self-deprecation, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, the heartwarming part of it is that throughout the, you know, the end of this chapter is like spans a couple of weeks where, you know, he still won't talk to the other boys at first, even though they're no longer hitting him in the field, but eventually he does. Eventually he jokes, you know, with them and starts making fun with the group, you know, as the group and stuff. And so that's really heartwarming to see that, that John really allowed him to be in a position where he might be able to flourish after all.
No, it's good.
Mm.
Even though he would be much preferring bunnies or puppies or whatever the book says.
He said something about kittens, which I thought was hilarious.
Kittens, his passions, I have it right here. His passions were books and kittens and dancing, as clumsy as he was.
Aww, doesn't that sound like, Sam.
This sounds like a modern day joke. You know, something that someone would say now, which is, I love that this book is filled with so many references that I feel like are so modern.
So there were two quick points I had for this chapter too, finishing up. But we know that Tywin Lannister is the warden of the East. Isn't he also the warden of the West, actually? Weren't we talking about this?
He's the warden of the West. And they're trying to get a warden of the East is what's happening.
In this chapter, we find out who the warden of the South is. It's this guy called Mace Tyrell, who, if he's anything like Mace Windu, is a bad SOB to watch out for. But Mace Tyrell. So actually, and we know the Tyrells. Well, we know Marguerite Tyrell,
who's
also
Loras.
Mentioned in these chapters as being like 14 years old and a maiden, a fair maiden. But I thought that was worth noting. And then also the word that they use for coward this whole chapter kind of got me off. I wasn't familiar with this word, craven. Obviously, like context clues, I was able to figure it out. But have you guys seen that word before?
Yeah, Wes Craven. Wes Coward.
I think so.
Wes Coward. I don't think that works well for him.
No.
He ought to have changed it if he had read these books. But the reason I bring it up is because there's a character, Craven, with a K, from Underworld. You know, that film, about vampires and werewolves.
Is that like Twilight?
Kind of like Twilight, a little before Twilight. But anyway, his character's revealed to be, a little bit of a coward in his own way. So I thought that was special and worth noting. We love tying Game of Thrones into other series.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, and you know, speaking about like other series, I just wanted to ask you about Sam. One thing that I was thinking, because I've always sort of thought that Samwell Tarly was sort of a bit of a homage to Samwise Gamgee.
Yes.
Both in his name, clearly, but also in his whole demeanor, the fact that he's sort of the fat hobbit kind of character. But I just, reading this chapter again, though, I sort of feel like Sam from Lord of the Rings is more sort of quietly heroic than Samwell is.
Yeah, but I feel like Samwell needs to also grow a little bit.
Yeah.
You know? And plus, Sam has this little like romance with Rosie. He's like too nervous to talk to her, and this doesn't happen for Samwell for like a book and a half or something.
But it does happen, though. I mean, interestingly enough.
You said it on this episode. There's also Pip, you know, in the crew.
Yes.
Like Merry and Pippin and Samwise. So I think the connection can certainly be drawn.
Yeah, also, his name is George R. Martin.
Here we go again.
So
we've just
throwing it out there.
There was one other thing that I noticed when reading through. There's this dream that John talks about that he has, and he's never shared it with anyone before but Sam. And you know, the quote is, "I'm walking around down this long empty hall. My voice echoes all around, but no one answers, so I walk faster, opening doors, shouting names. I don't even know who I'm looking for. Most nights it's my father, but sometimes it's Rob instead, or my little sister Arya, or my uncle." And, you know, it goes on and on. He talks about how he never finds anyone in his dreams. The castle is completely empty, and then, you know, it eventually leads down to the crypt where the old kings of winter are. And I'm wondering if that's foreshadowing to anything in the future.
Nah.
When he goes back to Winterfell. Should he go back to Winterfell?
He should go back to Hogwarts.
He should go back to Hogwarts.
Sorry. I mean, is John particularly gifted with foresight? Is he? He's not much like Bran in this. So maybe this is one of those cases where we can have sort of a casual dream and it not be, you know, the end of the world. You know what I'm saying?
But there's always something to dreams. in fantasy type novels.
That's true. So do you think that this is just another one of those showy ones, or is he, or like I said, or is he just trying to like put a dream in there for the dream's sake?
Yeah, I don't know either.
Yeah, I'm interested because isn't, if Lyanna is related to Jon Snow in any way, well, I mean, besides his being his aunt, if she's closer to him, like, isn't she buried down there? So
she is.
He could be afraid of facing his mother or something weird.
Maybe. I think he's just afraid of all the shit that's going to be happening, or maybe it is a little bit of foresight or premonition about the war. Like, Arya's going to go into some crazy shit. Rob's going to go into some crazy shit. You know, everyone is doing all this crazy stuff, and then maybe at the end of it, you know, pay homage to the Kings of Winter. Like, he's going to eventually be a ranger or something, and he's going to eventually be out there, and he's worried about Benjen, who went under. Like, there's lots of different things that it could mean.
Yeah.
Well, it also says here that, you know, as he approaches the crypts, that I scream that I'm not a Stark, that this isn't my place, but it's no good. I have to go anyway, so I start down, feeling the walls as I descend, with no torch to light the way. It gets darker and darker until I want to scream.
It's because he's a total Stark.
That's some deep shit right there.
It is.
I have to have a glass of water. Hold on a second.
Yeah, hold on. Let me take a sip, too.
It's that deep.
That was good water.
Before we move on to the next chapter, the only other thing that I had was we did get a mention of a character that obviously plays a role in season two, but it's the first time that I can remember him being brought up in this book, and that's Corrin Halfhand.
Uh-oh.
But that's just kind of a side note.
Ominous.
He's out looking for Benjen Stark.
Yeah, can I ask, why do you think they keep bringing up Benjen?
All the attention that they're putting toward Benjen Stark, and this is not a spoiler, guys who are listening, we're all friends here. I feel like it's a little too powerful and obvious for him just to be dead. So I personally think he's not dead. That's what I think. Mm-hmm. Also, Dumbledore is not dead. So
no.
You can They're use both of those facts and assert your own opinion.
Tell me, guys, I have a question for all of you, especially Selena. Have you ever thrown a wicked, crazy party where all your neighbors have brought their best, like, whores and smiths, and have you been not able
Selena
to
Selena does that every weekend. Aren't you friends with her on Facebook?
Don't you know?
And have
I'm
you
so
not
tired?
Been able to control the party after it got started? Because that is what this king's or this hand's tournament seems to be turning out to be.
Are you serious?
Yeah, a woman's head was found floating in the Great Sept.
What do you expect? They ate that priest or whatever he was in season two when they were trying to come back from the. Where were they walking back from? With Joffrey and Sansa. You know what I'm talking about?
They ate a priest.
Yeah, they like ripped his limbs off.
That's bad luck, man.
Who did that?
Oh, it's after they sent off Myrcella and they were walking back.
Oh, yeah, they did.
That was a riot.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Well, it's the same people, Eric.
Well, the same place. King's Landing.
They
apparently
did.
So they found a woman's head floating in the rainbow pool.
The rainbow
Nobody seems
pool.
To know how it got there or who it belongs to.
Maybe she wasn't good at her job.
It's a suspicious head floating in the rainbow pool.
Maybe she deserved to have her head thrown off and put into the rainbow pool. Sure.
It's a very suspicious head, my lord, floating in the rainbow pool. Can we give it a look?
She didn't know what the rainbow deliver pool on is. Her services that she was paid for, so they cut off the part of the body that wasn't functioning properly.
So what you're saying, I'm leaving that one. I'm leaving that one.
So I mean, I thought one of the funniest things in the Ned chapter, when they're planning this whole party, is that Renly, you know, comes up to Ned and starts talking about Loras' sister. The whole idea of her being a young Lyanna. And Ned is looking at this whole thing, and it strikes him as, and I quote, more than passing queer. And I just thought that was hilarious.
What does?
Just the whole thing about Renly.
You know that Renly was like nervous, like, and like saving it up. He's like, I can't wait to show Ned this picture of Margaery. I hope that he thinks it looks like his sister. I've heard so many good things about his sister. And he's like, hey, Ned, your hand. I just wanted to show you this. There's this girl that I was thinking about asking out to the tournament for you. And I was wondering if you thought that he looked like your sister. And Ned's just looking at it and he's thinking that stuff. And he's like, nah, it doesn't look like it at all. What a jackass thing to do.
Yeah, Ned really has his own things to worry about. He can't really worry about Renly's problems.
I know, but Renly was just being nice, and he really likes Renly too, so that was interesting.
He does like Renly, and he actually is wondering if he'll meet or be reacquainted with Stannis They're talking about Stannis kind of brooding somewhere and whether or not he's going to come to the tournament, which is good because obviously we know Stannis only from season two, you know, in the series, but I'm glad that they're talking about him and there's some backstory on him, even that bit about how he survived the siege of Storm's End. Is talked about, like Ned thinks about it while they're all on, is it the council or something here? You know, before the tournament.
Ned also steps up and becomes more of a detective in this chapter. And, you know, he starts to enlist some of his own people to help in this regard. And it leads us further and further along into the chapter. And we eventually finally get to meet Gendry for the first time, which
Yay!
Was, we have cheers. You know, he questioned, I'm going to try to say this guy's name, Tobo Mott. So it kind of sounds like an applesauce company. Tobo Mott is the guy who's hanging out with Gendry and teaching him how to make helmets that he wears in questionable times that eventually saves his life. And immediately when Ned sees Gendry, he sees the resemblance to the king when he was younger. Now remember this. This is the same chapter that he shot down the king's brother, looking like someone else. And then when he sees Gendry, he's like, oh, shit. So we know that Ned is biased. Or, excuse me, we know that Ned is not biased. We know that he's for real, like, this for real looks like Gendry, so we can trust his opinion, right?
Yeah, I love how he gives no indication at all that he knows that. And we don't know it until he leaves. And it's just like the last line of the chapter is like, you know, wonder what Robert's bastard is doing on the Street of Steel or something. And I'm like, whoa.
Yeah.
Like, he totally knew it was Gendry. He asked him like two questions and he knew. But that was awesome. And he's following in John Aaron's footsteps. You're right, Zach. He's being this detective. And I think how that whole conversation gets started is Ned asks Mott the Hoople about, you know, what John Aaron was doing. And he was like, oh, he asked to see the boy. And Ned doesn't know what he's talking about at all, but he's like, I should like to see the boy as well. He's like, yeah, that's why I came here.
I love that.
What
that
boy? I'm going to see the boy too.
I'm starting to get a little bit worried here for Sherlock Stark, because I think he's starting to sniff down the wrong trail. It's nothing to lose your head over right now.
Oh,
yeah, I'm sure it'll be fine.
Yeah, it shouldn't end up in the Rainbow Pool or anything.
Find yourself waiting in the Rainbow Pool. Please ignore the.
So is that like Renly's residence while he's there?
The Rainbow Pool?
It's what he bathes in on a daily basis.
Well, the next chapter sees, you know, a very, very important chapter about Catelyn, where she finally has that big confrontation with Tyrion that pretty much changes the entire rest of the series. I mean, this chapter, this is, in my opinion, the catalyst for everything else that happens. And what happens at this inn at the crossroads, which, by the way, is also a really awesome cookbook. This is really, this
what?
Like, it is, it is. Someone made a fan cookbook. It's amazing.
Okay.
But inn at the crossroads, pretty cool. But not only because singer Marillion is introduced, who might pop up later in the story.
Is he part of Bone Thugs and Harmony?
Yeah, he is, actually.
Possibly is. No, but this chat, I mean, this moment in the series, if Catelyn didn't make the choices that she did, I would argue that nothing that bad would have happened. But this is pretty, and it's funny because you start this chapter going to this inn, seeing these people sitting around eating and singing and all that, and you just think, once this war breaks out, all that is gone. We know that the inn is destroyed, that the woman who whatever her name was, she's hanged. We know that all this terrible stuff happens, and it's just like a perfect example that right now the world is harsh, but it's okay. After this, it's just hell from here on out forever.
Well, thanks for putting in perspective for me, Selena, because
really...
I just thought this was a passing chapter where some cool shit happens at the end.
Yeah.
But
this
I didn't realize that this
for...
decision would adversely affect Catelyn's, you know, and the whole view of the Starks, even as you alluded to.
Well, it changes, like she's saying, if it wasn't for Cat seizing Tyrion in this chapter, there would have been no actual war. Like, there was no war declared by the Starks yet, you know, on the Lannisters. Like, if this shit didn't happen, there would have been no crazy fighting. They wouldn't have taken Tyrion captive to the Vale, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It would have been much different.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I'll be the first to defend Catelyn because, I mean, she was undercover, essentially, not wanting to get involved. And Tyrion, you know, without thinking, it also, I guess it wasn't completely his fault, but, you know, she just reacts defensively because she's there as, I mean, they're there as father and daughter. Catelyn sees Tyrion walk in. He's like, oh, Lady Stark, da 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 da. And she has no choice but to immediately remind the other men, I think it's up to like 12 guys in the place, that they have sworn their swords to, the Stark I believe it's just the Starks, all the bannermen. And she calls the bannermen to seize Tyrion. But ultimately, she didn't want to. I guess she wouldn't have done that if he hadn't pointed her out, because she was just trying to, lay low in a place and seek shelter while she moved north.
This entire scene like seemed like an old West movie to you guys. Like they just arrived in the same smoky, dimly lit Western saloon. Tyrion and his boys are on this side. Kat's, incognito with Sir Roderick, and Tyrion notices her. And I just thought it was so like sly how she did the entire thing. Yeah. Like the entire time she was like, so do you guys love my family? And she starts going on about all these people that have allegiance to them. And they're like, yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, this guy, while he was staying at my house, consorted with enemies to have my son stabbed or cut by a knife. And then she holds her hands up. This didn't happen. And she goes, and look at my hands, for proof.
they're all bleeding. Sweaty.
Yeah. And then it all happens. It's just, I feel like it was such a showdown, like a real one.
It really was. And Tyrion saw it coming only like a little too late, where he's like, I'm not sure what the meaning of this is. He says that to her. He's like getting freaked out at this point because she's just rallying off all the people who are like loyal to her, like for seemingly no reason. And he's kind of like, I think he has some inkling, obviously. These two strangers cross on the road and they know each other and they have that history of her son nearly having just died. But he's very, I think he's freaked out. Do you think he could have put up a fight though? Do you think his men really could have held him off, or could he have paid them all off not to attack him? Because you saw what they did when he tossed that gold coin. This other guy gave up his own room as if there was like another inn right next door, which there's not on the King's Road.
I guess that raises the question though. I mean, are you bound by honor? Are you in allegiance? Or are you bound by money?
Yeah, you're bound by honor. Okay,
or it's like a mixture of both,
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously it's at the discretion of the family or the person. But, because I think we see that a lot throughout the series, kind of where do allegiances lie?
Maud.
Maud.
No, you're right though, and it's not like Tyrion was traveling with a whole bunch of soldiers that were on his side. Like he had Yorin with him, which is pretty neutral. I think that Tyrion could have put up an actual like real big fight if he would have just been like, "Hey, my sister's the queen," and like just really try to like pull his name out there and promise people money like he did with the tribes people. Like I feel like it would have been a little different, but he was pretty screwed in this moment, and I don't think he was really thinking clearly.
I do like the sort of the kick ass moment that Catelyn has, knowing where it all leads. That's kind of it's kind of bittersweet, but just for her as a character, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, like I said, it was just a big ass showdown, and she owned him so hard.
Oh yeah,
and isn't that how one of the episodes ended?
It really did, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's such a memorable moment, isn't it? Because that was the moment when I remember watching the show going, yeah, win for the Starks. And then half a season later, I was like, oh, crap. Shouldn't have done that.
You're like, wait, I love Tyrion. Screw you. I don't like you, Catelyn. You're mean. No, it's true, though. This whole part of the book, and I would say the book, and I mean this whole part of the story, the show and the book included, was really exciting just to watch because you're mid-season or you're mid-book and it's the first book or it's the first show. And like, especially for me, having watched the show first, I feel like I was getting introduced to so many people and so many cool things. And knowing, finally, we have the chapter where we're sitting with Sansa and it's from her perspective and we're watching pieces of the tournament. And I thought, being able to meet the different people and to see the king being drunk in public and to see like these bets go down and stuff, it was so cool to get just another layer added on top of the story and to see that it was going to be much more than just small conflicts and drama.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. There is this grand nature to the tournament. I mean, it spans these two chapters. We see from two different perspectives, but we hear about so many more people. The Mountain and the Hound both fight, first individually and then even each other and their brothers and all this stuff happens. It's very epic. It's very epic, and it's amazing how he's still able to write this and maintain the perspective and not, and it have it not feel weird. You know, it still feels like we're getting it from Sansa's perspective. And, you know, again, with Ned, he has each of the characters, I guess, occupied doing their own thing during these events, but we still get quite a lot of coverage.
And I think it's the first time that we actually see a glimpse of Sansa being something more than just a vapid little bird, you know, as Sandor calls her later in the chapter, because she has that moment when she's sitting at the tournament and it's all beautiful and flowers and colors and what have you. And then she sees her first man die right in front of her. And she has that moment when she feels nothing. You know, Jane Poole, her friend, has to be led away because she's in hysterics. And Sansa is just like, huh, I know I should feel something, but I don't. Yeah. And that's sort of the, you know, she's made of tough stuff. You know, she's a Stark, despite the fact that she is really hard to like in these first couple of chapters. I'm not going to lie. You know, there's substance there. There's a reason that we're going to really enjoy her later.
I thought it was really cool when the entire stuff with Loras happened and he gave her the red rose and, you know, pulled out that line. Because, again, on top of all of that, it makes Sansa look so much less innocent than she is because mm-hmm. she's getting seen by these other people. And she's, I don't know, I feel like that's not a really a little kid moment. And then someone dies.
Yes.
I felt like I just made the comparison to the Hunger Games where they say that Peeta makes Katniss desirable by saying that he, desires her. But, like, yeah. That kind of made Sansa look good when she got the flower. She got a rose. All the other flowers were white. And she got the red rose from Ser Loras.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, she's turning some heads, I think.
She's turning, not Septa Mordaines, though.
Septa is too busy drunk and snoring.
Yeah, she's out. She's out. She's down for the count.
Although that's later, I think. She had to take Jane away.
And she catches the attention, Sansa, of Baelish as well in this chapter. And you know what I realized when I was reading this about how Baelish is all like, oh, you have your mother's look. I was like, Baelish is to Sansa what Snape would have been like to Harry had Harry been a girl. Yeah. Am I right? Is that not right?
No, it's like, so it's totally
that
right. Except
creepy
that
affection.
Baelish really likes Sansa. But,
yeah, but I think Sansa
Snape would have really liked Harry too, yeah.
Yeah, if he was a girl, like if he was a little Lily, I think he would have had that same, it would have been a completely different novel then.
Totally
he
creepy, would have inappropriate, yeah.
Like,
oh,
yeah.
Little Lily, Snape with his pointed beard.
Oh, Harriet Potter. Oh, my God, we just started
Potter.
A new story.
No, we've done a Muggle cast on that.
Oh, okay. Was it Harriet that you guys used?
I think, yeah, we said something like that.
Oh, okay, well, great minds. Okay.
Yeah, great minds, totally an instance of great minds, but... Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Littlefinger was kind of awkward, but I guess in the next chapter, he then is taking or placing bets. So he seemed to recover, I guess, from whatever it was that he was feeling when he approached Sansa.
Yes.
But I think it's an interesting opening to that story because Sansa sort of so wrapped up in her handsome knights and suddenly this short, weird man is standing in front of her completely enthralled and she's really put off by it. But I think it's funny that this is the guy that she's probably going to have more interaction with than most of those knights around her.
Yeah.
This is the first time that we see Littlefinger after hearing about, in the previous chapter, how Catelyn and her, you know, when she was young, fed him mud pies. so many that he got sick. So I was just like, I was feeling bad for the guy. And then he comes up and is like, touching Sansa's hair and stuff. And I was like,
yeah, but again, guys, is that weird that in that time or in this story, at least her age was pretty acceptable, right?
Yeah. 13. As soon as she flowers, she's ready to marry.
She's breeding age.
Like, oh God, that's some stuff. But hey, I mean, whatever. But I don't think that, I don't think that Baelish is something that she's trying to go after because like Joffrey, he's a prince. He might be a little shitbag, but I mean, he's a prince. He's an eligible bachelor, if you will. And he sits with Sansa and makes her heart skip a beat. And so I don't know. Like, I don't think that really the probably only other thing that may have made her heart skip a beat is the person dying, but it's pretty clear that she doesn't care about that.
I thought that made me think less of her. The fact that she wasn't moved by his death. You know, like the fact that she's so giddy about Ser Loras and so giddy about Joffrey and so breathtaking and taken aback. And then this knight dies in front of her or the squire dies in front of her. And she's just like, okay.
I think it's trying to paint the context that she is not only strong, but she's also very shallow and sort of fits in with the women there in King's Landing. Like the people of lesser people, non-highborn, their deaths are, I don't know, it's just not as big of a deal to them. Like that's why they're able to see things like wars and tournaments and have lesser people die, and they don't really allow it to phase them.
I guess she's just really good at fitting in. You know, and that's what Sander says as well. She's a little bird who repeats the words that she's learned, and it's why I think in season two someone says to her, "You're gonna outlive us all," because she can do that. She's just like a chameleon.
So when he's escorting her home, he finally tells the story of his face.
It's told by Baelish, right, in the TV series, which kind of sets like an ominous tone over the whole tournament when he's sitting there talking about how, you know, this really distant relationship was created between these two brothers, though it seems like they were always distant with each other. They never really got along very well. And that, you know, the mountain actually is responsible for his brother looking the way that he does. And there doesn't seem to be any love loss, any remorse between the two of them. If anything, they seem to really hate each other.
Also, he should be jealous of his brother's nickname. He's called the Mountain. He's called the Hound.
I know.
One's going to win more.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, not even the Mountain. The Mountain that rides.
I thought that was Hodor's
name.
No, but the Mountain is bigger mountain than even Hodor.
Hodor is the mountain that carries other mountains. Like, we just discovered that the Mountain actually rides Hodor. That's the only way he's able to get around and to move the entire mountain. Otherwise, they're pretty equal.
Yeah, I don't know. The Hound, like, lashes out at Sansa. At first, I wasn't liking that at all. He's, like, really angry with her about her being polite about it all. She was like, oh, nobody could withstand him, da 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 da. She's talking about the Mountain, and he just like flips out and kind of wants to vilify his brother, I think, in front of Sansa, and so tells her the story of sibling, like, what's the word, jealousy or envy, where, you know, as boys, the Mountain got this wooden knight, and the Hound wanted it, so he took it, and then his brother held his face to the embers for a very long time. And it took three men to pull him away. Like, that's insane. Yeah. But at the same time, it's not entirely lost. Like, the moral of it, like, at the end of the chapter, she pities him. You know, they walk silently home, the rest of it all. But still, like, it made me think of Sansa and Arya arguing. How neither of them would hold the other's face to the flames and disfigure them for life.
Right.
So they have that.
Over a toy, no less.
Yeah, I've kind of had the same happen to me over a Mortal Kombat fight on the Super Nintendo, but it wasn't fire, it was other stuff. So, I mean, yeah, it gets crazy with brothers.
Did you get squishied after Mortal Kombat?
I've gotten lots of things after Mortal Kombat in Tekken 3. Yeah.
Who was your favorite player?
In which game?
Mortal Kombat, the original.
Sub-Zero or Raiden, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah,
those two were the best, I think we can all agree.
They're pretty good. Scorpion's meh, and the rest of them. Liu Kang is like, oh, I love everyone. I like Liu Kang. It's like, well, who cares? He's the main character. I'm going to go for the guy from the underworld, and he shoots ice out of his hands, right out of his palms.
Speaking of ice.
Speaking of fire and ice.
And fire.
Wow.
Yeah.
You mean ice and fire?
Yeah, that's what I meant. I meant to say that.
Yeah, just changed it up a bit.
Yeah, we're just mixing it up.
Yeah, so the big thing that happens, we talked about this before, the big thing that happens that night is Robert gets very, very drunk and not volunteers, he declares that he will be fighting the next day. And Cersei is like, no, I forbid it. And he's like, woman, you know, get back in your cage. And he, like, slams it, and then there's, like, this big scene. Now, Ned was woken in the middle of the night and told about this proclamation of Robert's, that he was going to fight the next day. And so his first order of business in the morning is to talk Robert out of it.
He's like, no, man, you got really big.
Yeah.
And this was tough, but it established kind of even better, not established, it kind of reinforced the relationship between Robert and Ned. The fact that Ned is able to go up to him and say, hey, look, man, you're too fat for your armor. Like, what the hell? And Ned, like, Robert storms around, and then he's like, yeah, you're right.
This armor needs to be let out a little bit more.
Why do you think that Robert wants to fight? What do you think he's trying to achieve by this? Do you think he's just, like, trying to show off for Ned, or...?
I believe it's fairly obvious that he's sick and tired of doing the political game and being the king. Mm. I think he wants to be the kind of person that he was with Ned, and Ned's doing nothing but remind him of the kind of people that they were.
Yeah, 100%. There's a line I pulled from my notes, and it says, this is Robert talking, he says, I swear to you, I was never so alive as when I was winning this throne, or so dead as now that I've won it.
Mm, yeah. That's sad.
I think that pretty much says it. Like, yeah, he wants to be that boy, that like that young man again with Ned, like Ned coming to King's Landing just reminds him of who he was, like we just said. He wants it back, and I think the years and years of dealing with the Lannisters and the politics, you know, this is all, he said it before too about sitting the throne, you know, being a great burden, but it's really wearing him out, and he even blames it for his, I want to say obesity, but he blames it for his, you know, eating and drinking so much. The fact that he's too fat for his armor, he blames it all on the fact that he was made king and it should have been Ned or somebody else. And Ned says, oh, but you had the best claim. So there is that.
Which is interesting in itself. Do you think that Ned would ever have taken the throne? Because I was always under the impression that he was fighting for Robert always.
You mean like, do you think they decided long before the Battle of the Trident that it was going to be Robert who was who they were essentially campaigning for?
Yeah, they were like, let's kill the old king so Robert can take the throne.
Right, it was never like, let's kill the old king so that one of us can take the throne and we'll figure it out once he's dead.
I think that it's pretty clear. It's been made pretty clear that Robert was obviously like the coolest guy. Like he was like the strongest. He was the most like versatile. He was the most well liked. And I think that maybe Ned was probably a little bit too, what's the word, introverted compared to Robert. So Robert was probably the obvious choice. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I agree exactly with what you said. And there's sort of this period of reflection really for Robert where he's sitting there and he's talking about, you know, Loras Tyrell. And what a great, you know, warrior he really is, and how he would be proud to have a son like that. He even talks about Joffrey and says, "You know, basically, how could I have produced that? You know, and how could I have made a son like that? You know, he looks at him as this little prat, this little
Draco Malfoy.
Exactly. Yeah. No, that's exactly how he looks at him, and then he looks at some of the other, you know, young men that are fighting in this tournament, and how he would really, you know, be proud to call any of them son. But Joffrey, he looks at as being just kind of a weak link.
The tournament is such an odd thing to throw into the story. And it's not odd in the sense of a negative connotation, but it was, I feel like it was so smart and pivotal, not as pivotal as the scene with Kat and Tyrion, but pivotal in the sense that we're introducing so many different characters and so many different families that if we set our deduction points to done now, we can understand sort of and just guess what's going to happen for the rest of the story. Because even Stannis isn't there, and that's questionable. He's the brother of the king, and the Hand is celebrating a new second in command of the whole kingdom, and he's not there.
Yeah, but even as you were saying about introducing characters, there's a point where they're walking down and all the house sigils are mentioned, like of the entire realm.
Yeah.
You know, that apparently there's a house with two towers as their thing.
The two towers.
And lots of fruit and lots of animals. That's all I gathered from that whole long paragraph.
So the crazy scene that happened in the show actually did happen in the book, and we got to read it. The Mountain the Ride loses to Loras. I'm not going to read your copy, Eric. Loses to Loras, and Loras' horse. And so the Mountain gets pissed because he's the Mountain, and Loras is like this really talented dude who's also attractive, and it just makes people mad sometimes. And he slaughters his own horse. Now, in the show, I feel like the people that I've watched the show with have become more shocked at something like that than they were at people getting stabbed or shadows coming out of people's holes. Like, I feel like the part where he cuts his own horse's head off was like the craziest thing people have seen so far.
This was sad. This was when I cried.
There, yeah.
I didn't cry during the Sam chapter, but I cried when he cut his own horse's head off.
No, you did not. No, you did not.
Okay. You call bullshit, fine. I'll cede bullshit. But I really did feel more bad for the horse than I did for Sam in the previous chapter.
Right.
You have to feel bad for the horses because it's not their fault. Like, that's the whole point of why it's so sad when animals die in stories, because they're not fighting. They're just like, oh, I'm going to go eat some hay today. And they're like, no, you're going to run into this ring and I'm going to spear you.
But we'll give you hay later. They're like, okay, fine.
If you survive.
Is there hay later?
Hey, no, later.
Not for you, because you got stabbed by a sword down your neck.
Exactly. It's hard to be a horse.
So he decides to kill the person that was riding the horse afterward. And, you know, it makes total sense. That's just logistically where your mind would go afterward. And then his bro steps in and they start to fight to the death, which I feel is just a spectacle that we should be able to watch. And Robert let us watch it a little bit before he broke it up, which I thought was very funny. And I think that we solidified the reason why he is the king, because he has the loudest voice in the room. And he yells, and they could hear it all the way to Karth, and that was the end of that fight.
That duck sauce is like, what the hell was that?
What was that?
He like looks up, and it's just Robert's voice from afar. Yeah, in a world without Sonorous, you really need somebody like Robert to lead.
Right.
It's strange, though. The Hound has really weird motivations in these chapters, because first he tells Sansa his life story for like no reason, and now he goes in and saves Loras. Like, why Loras?
I think he saw that opportunity to defy his brother.
That's sure. That's a good point.
But do you think, like, what would have happened? Let's just hypothetical. I know none of us can really answer this, but what do you think would have happened to the Mountain if he had killed Loras? Like, would he have been dishonored? Because obviously that's a very dishonorable thing to do as a knight, not only to slay your own horse after battle, but then to flip out and go and try and kill the other knight.
I think House Tyrell probably would have had an issue.
I think they would have drowned him in the Rainbow Pool.
Can you drown the mountain that rides? Can you even get close?
Renly would have kicked his ass, because Renly's a badass. I think Renly would have stepped down and just destroyed some shit.
Yeah, I don't know. The mountain seems immovable, almost, except for the fact that he rides. But this clash, you know, the Hound and the Mountain, was exciting to read. And you're right, his motives are questionable. Like, after he tells Sansa that, at the end of that chapter, he says, you know, you tell anybody, and she's like, I won't. He's like, anybody, and I'll kill you. And it's like, oh. So why do you even put yourself in that situation where some little girl knows your secret? Like, he's a very interesting character. He's like on my top three most wanting to know more about at this point. The fact that he stands in for Loras was completely defenseless. Anybody, really, even though, you know, having just won a joust or whatever it was, completely defenseless when the mountain decides that he or it wants to kill you. You know, only the Hound can stand up to him. And that, I saw like a really, you know, coming together of that childhood story, you know, these brothers who have this rivalry going. And the Hound wants to prove that he's like almost as good as the Mountain now, or can stand up to him, whereas before he was just defenseless.
So after the Mountain and the Hound go at it for a little while, Ned is able to go and relax in his chambers. And, you know, he comes across Arya, who he learns from, you know, her dancing lessons are improving a bit. And he seems a little bit hesitant at first, though. You know, the fact that she has physical bruises on her from, you know, all the training that's been going on. So I think Ned is a little bit hesitant that, you know, basically Syrio is taking some liberties with her. But I think it's Arya who says, you know, that you don't learn anything, you know, unless you walk away from these lessons with at least one bruise or something to that effect. I can't remember the exact line, but basically that it's evidence that you worked hard and that you're learning in some way.
I like that Ned's relaxing and doing his thing, and he's sort of he's doing what we've all done in the past, but he's just like, all right, what the hell's going on? So he starts remembering everything, and he starts thinking about all of the stuff that he has learned and what has led up and what has caused the reason for John Arryn's death. And all of these things are swimming through his head. And there's a knock at the door, and we are visited by a certain insect.
Instead of smelling like perfume or whatever Varys normally smells like, now he just smells like sweat. Probably an improvement.
Maybe he's working out.
Ned gets a visit from Varys, and this is a very, very interesting conversation that they have, because Varys literally outright like justifies the first half of this, or the first third of this book. You know, basically there's two things Varys tells Ned. The first is that there is like currently ongoing a conspiracy to kill Robert. And this is said, you know, basically by Varys talking to Ned about Robert's pride and how, you know, by Cersei saying, I forbid you to go fight in this battle. It's not that she was like his hurt wife. By forbidding Robert to do anything, that's the first thing he's going to do, is be defiant and jump right into the battle. So Varys is suggesting that all these people, that it was apparently that Robert was supposed to be killed during the melee that broke a lot of fingers earlier in the day. And that, to me, is shocking that Varys can be so, I want to say, candorous to Ned about this. But apparently, until now, Varys wasn't sure he could trust Ned until today. So I guess that's why. But we do get a lot of answers from Varys.
You know what we also get in this is that by the end of the chapter, Varys actually tells Ned straight out, I wouldn't be able to bring this conspiracy to the king because they would have my head. You know, Sir Ilan Payne would have my head off. But for you, I know that Ilan Payne would even defy the Lannisters and not be able to chop your head off. Which, of course, is a blatant lie. I mean, I doubt that Varys actually believes that Ilan Payne would not kill Ned. And the funny thing is that that's exactly what he does. It's just, it's interesting that he would come straight out. First of all, it's great foreshadowing. And second, Varys is clearly lying to him, which I think is interesting. Because then we can't trust anything he says.
But I wouldn't say he was clearly lying. I didn't think he was lying.
I don't see, that's what I wonder, because... You know, obviously events play themselves out and Robert meets, an untimely end in the next couple of chapters. But I wonder if Ned was able to tell Robert in enough time, would Varys have, kept the allegiance sort of with Ned and Robert and, things played out that way as opposed to, really sort of towing the Lannister line, which we learn he does later on.
Well, it's just the thing that he says about Ilan Payne being so loyal or respectful of Ned that he wouldn't chop his head off, even if it was a direct order.
Yeah.
But reading this book and not knowing who Ilan Payne is from the series, I don't think that it's a lie at this point. Reading it at this point, Varys is being completely genuine. Only because I don't know any better. I think that Varys is being very forthcoming. And so, I mean, are you suggesting that he's revealing this plot on Robert's head so that Ned goes and gets himself killed too?
I think it's blatantly obvious that he's going to say lots of things to twist Ned's head around, because that's the kind of character that we've been introduced. Like, that's what we've been told, the kind of person that he is. So to say that Ilan Payne wouldn't chop his head off because he respects him so much, I want to be like, dude, that's some bullshit.
No, it's not necessarily because he wants Ned to fail in this. It's just he wants Ned to do a certain thing, and he's going to say whatever he wants, like you said, Zach, to get him to do that. And I think that saying to him, even though we don't know this at this point, knowing what we know later, we know now, reading this back, who Ilan Payne is. We know it as well as Varys knows it. And I think that Varys very well knows that Ilan Payne would not hesitate to chop anyone's head off. But if he can make Ned believe it, then he can make him lose that fear for whatever purpose.
I feel like you're getting this look at Varys, though, and he's such a player in this game. He may be the ultimate player in this game. But the question is why? What is his motivation?
I don't know.
I guess we still haven't figured that out yet.
Yeah, I mean, I thought he was very forthcoming. I mean, he basically says, like, there's this whole development these past two chapters where Ned was going to interview the squire that Sansa watched die in the tourney. And then we learned from Varys that that kid is actually the very squire who poisoned Jon Arryn. And furthermore, Varys tells Ned exactly how Jon Arryn was in fact poisoned by the Tears of Lys or whatever they are.
Yeah, I mean, I just never understand with characters like Varys and Baelish, why not kill them? They're more trouble than they're worth, and they're obviously trying to fulfill their own agenda, but it doesn't seem like, no matter who's talking about them, nobody trusts them.
Don't you see what they're doing for themselves? And I've seen, I mean, this happens in real life all the time, but what they've done is they've both made, because they're very similar people, they've both made monstrous efforts to becoming important with Ned. Almost indispensable with Ned. And I'm sure they've done that with every person on their own. They make themselves valuable to these people. These people depend on them for information or for yada, yada, yada. And they couldn't dream of this person betraying them. Like, they basically are just too smart for their own good, and they're just sucking up to people. So no one's just going to go kill them, because they have some kind of value to these other brutish people that maybe aren't as sharp in the wit department.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
I like it.
Me too.
So I don't want to say that that's my own of the week, but we are crawling to that point. To where it's time for us to share those owns of the week. And if you haven't caught on at this point yet, all of us are dead asleep, especially Selena, who's Well, it's like 17 a.m. or something. Like, what time is it over there?
Yeah, we have crazy times like that. So it's actually 75.
Oh, 75 a.m. So it's nuts. I'm in a different time zone. Erickson, none of us this time are in any different or any time zones that are similar. So that's my own of the week. We're pulling it off this time.
Oh, wow.
That's good.
Well, it remains to be seen if we pulled it off, but I have confidence.
We're getting there. So who wants to go first with their own?
I'll go so that nobody takes it.
There you go.
That woman's head, the unknown woman's head, totally owned the rainbow pool.
There you go.
Aww. Perfect. For me, it has to be in the first chapter that John totally owned the other boys and kept John safe because, kept Sam safe because, their bromance is amazing.
Aww. Yep. They did good. They did well.
They melted the wall of my heart. Aww.
They melted your heart. Swedish heart.
Yes.
Oh, but my heart is melted. Okay, sorry guys.
Okay.
Mine comes from the chapter that we just read by, said by Robert. He says, "Ah, say that I'm a better king than Aerys and be done with it. You never could lie for love nor honor, Ned Stark. I'm still young, and now that you're here with me, things will be different. We'll make this a reign to sing of and damn the Lannisters to seven hells. I smell bacon." It was really just because of that "I smell bacon" line.
Yeah, I gathered that. Yeah. All right. Well, mine is sort of like Selena's. My own of the week is not on the boys. Rather, my own of the week is on Alistair Thorne, because those boys... Actually, it's from John to Thorne, because John, having been mistreated by this guy so much, has taken this guy's training session and has turned it into a couple of like children just standing there saying, "No, I don't want to hit him. No." Like, so he's totally owned this guy who's like an adult, and this is his full-time job. This is his honor and shit. Like, he's the guy who trains people, and the people he's training, his recruits, just do not want to fight. And like, John's got like this mob boss, like tight clinch over them. Like, "Hey, I'll kick your ass if you don't," essentially. So yeah, good stuff. No one touches him.
It's like cheating if you use your dire wolf.
If you use a wolf to write us owns of the week, then we'll probably not read them on the show because they won't be legible by English or Swedish handwriting, which is the only two languages that we're able to read. And I don't believe that Google Translate has listed dire wolfian yet, but we're probably within a few months of that.
Oh, and they should.
If you want to be hot on the trail of all those updates involving dire wolfian language transcription, you can find them at gameofowns.com, because that's probably something that we would easily write about.
Speaking of owns, I just want to give an update to Johanna from Sweden. She has officially made me an honorary Swede.
I saw that.
Thank you very much. I'm very honored.
Are you guys going to hang out?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. You guys could eat like Turkish
Swedish
delight.
Meatballs.
Even though it's not in Sweden. Yeah.
Also, don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter for all the latest owns and for news about when the shows are released and coming out and being recorded. We are at twitter.com/gameofowns. You can find each of our individual Twitter handles on the website. And also, we have a Facebook at facebook.com/gameofowns. And if you want to email us, you can do that at contact@gameofowns.com.
And you can find me on hypable.com, hypable.com, which is just a fantastic resource for anything and everything fandom-wise. And we've got so many podcasts these days that you can check out. And a forums at forum.hypable.com.
I'm in the forum. I've written a few forum posts, Selena.
You're in the forum? Are you trolling our forum?
I wasn't trolling. I've written a few posts. I'm a
That's
part of the
great.
Community.
Go stalk Zach in the forums.
Yeah, you'll find some really interesting shit. No, the forums are great. There's a lot of you guys in the forum talking about Game of Owns and respective threads. We're reading it, guys, and we love you. And it's probably a little strong to come out and say that, but I just got to tell you how my feelings are. I'm just going to be real with you. So that's how I feel.
And of course, you can rate and review us on iTunes. We appreciate your 5-star reviews. Nothing less, of course, is acceptable. And this week, if you fail to give us a 5-star rate and review, you will be forced to milk.
Oh, gosh.
Half a gallon of milk. Actually, you know what? Let me change that. Hold on a sec. You'll be forced to suck half a gallon of milk from Lysa Aaron's left tit. And before you start thinking that that's some, you know, great prize, that real estate's not what it used to be.
No, it's not.
Oh, my. Micah. She's the one who still nurses her kids.
Never happened
right?
in your life. You know that you should listen to Micah and continue to listen to Game of Thrones, this podcast. I need coffee. I'm Zach Louie.
I'm going
to
trust that Micah knows as much as he says he does about real estate, and I'm Eric Skoll.
I need sleep, and I'm Selena Wilkin. And to fix my Skype.
Fix your what?
Exactly.
My Skype.
I'm Micah Tenenbaum.
Goodbye, everybody.
Later.